We're going to spend a few minutes in just a moment here with Will Stewart, the general manager and columnist for TechSideline.com, who's a frequent guest of mine. He's a keen observer of all sports Virginia Tech, so we're going to talk a little basketball and football with Will. And then after we are done with Will, we're going to bring on the newest Hokie commitment. John Graves has agreed to join us for a few minutes. He's got a brief break from his job, and we'll talk to him a little more about the decision he made over the weekend and was announced yesterday at a press conference at his school. John Graves, the talented defensive end from Meadowbrook High School, will be a Hokie. We'll talk to him in our 8:30 hour. But right now, let's bring on the general manager of TechSideline.com, Will Stewart, who I know has his Christmas shopping done. That's kind of been a theme tonight, Will.
It's really funny, Mike. I haven't even started.
Neither's Chris Horn. What is it with you guys? You got to take a little time off and get some shopping done.
Sneaks up on me every year. I'm letting my wife spend all the money so far this year, and now I have to go and shop for her, and there's no money left, so.
Well, yeah, I would explain that to her. Of course, having young children, Santa Claus does the bulk of your work.
Yes,
you just got to buy for each other. You know, my kids are a little older, so I actually have to buy them stuff.
Yes, that's true.
Well, you know, you being an internet businessman, you'll know that I am doing my shopping through your route. I am trying to avoid stores at all costs, so.
You know what? I spend so much time on the computer, I'm actually going to get up and go to the mall. It'll be a huge break for me.
Yeah, that's true. You work on the internet. Who needs to shop on it? Hey, great column this week. I think you posted it just yesterday about the basketball team rounding into shape after 10 games and all they'd been through. So let's talk basketball first, and then we'll get into some football. Because I tell you, I saw the basketball team a few times and early in the season. I've seen them a couple times lately. And I was talking to a couple of the kids after the game, the win over St. John's. You know, I'm not a guy, I'm not a moral victory kind of guy. You either win or you lose. But if I'm going to be a moral victory guy, I'm going to be a moral victory over that Duke game. Because they kind of agreed. You know, obviously they'd rather that last second shot by Duke didn't go in. But after all they went through especially, that looked like it was going to be just a housing down there. And Duke needs a miracle to beat them. So it reinforced their idea that, hey, you know, we're a pretty good team here. You agree with that?
Yeah, I do. You know, I'm loath to use the term moral victory as well. But you know what I've been telling people, Mike? I've been telling people Virginia Tech beat Duke. They beat them that night. You know, it's just that Duke had an extra second and a half and hit a miracle half-court shot, and that's the way it's going to go into the record books. But, you know, all else being equal, you know, the Hokies, they did what they had to do. They came back and won that ball game. They just got beat on a fluky shot. You know, I think that they were starting to get better at that point in time, Mike, except for that, you know, terrible first half that they had against Ohio State, you know, in the game before that. I think they felt like they were coming on, and that really just kind of, to me, galvanized them. They played with a lot of confidence that night, you know, and Seth did a great job coaching as usual. And it you know, the mental effect it had on me, Mike, is you look at the Duke-Virginia Tech rivalry, and I'll call it a rivalry because it's been three great games. You know, that first game happened down there in Durham last year. Tech lost 100-65, but they did kind of take a stand that night with Seth getting kicked out of the game and all that. They basically said they're not intimidated by Duke. And then they beat him in Blacksburg. But, you know, still there's a part of you that wonders, was that a fluke, you know, the victory in Blacksburg? Did they just catch Duke on a bad night? And then to go down there and play toe-to-toe with them and actually have them beat down at Duke, I think that answers that question. I think for whatever reason they match up with Duke very well. And that kind of thing just bleeds in everything else. I think it gives you confidence in everything else, playing everybody else, particularly when you look at what Duke did to Texas.
Yeah.
The following Saturday, they just mauled them.
Right, 31 points, Reddick getting 41, and Tech's done a pretty good job with Reddick, at least in the last two games.
Yeah, you know, I think they've somehow gotten into J.J.'s head. Maybe it's the thing, he's from Roanoke, he's a local kid or whatever. I don't know. We'll have to see how he does in Blacksburg before we can pass final judgment on that.
Well, what impressed me much about that Duke game, now, and you and I have talked, I actually didn't cover. Bob Lipper covered it for us because I came back from the championship game to do the football follow. So I'm watching from my room in Blacksburg, and it kind of gets away at the end. Tech falls behind by 11, and the commentators are not saying it's over, but they're saying, you know, it's kind of gotten away. It's been a great effort. And then, you know, next thing you know, Tech reels off the 12 points to take the lead. And that impressed me the most is that when everybody, when there was every reason to believe, okay, nice try, guys, now go home and take your 15-point loss, they came back and took control of the game again, only to have that disappointing fluke. But those were the 4 minutes that said to me, wow, this team's got some tougher stuff than maybe I thought.
They've got something going on with Duke where, you know, Coleman Collins plays his best games against Sheldon Williams, and the Hokies are somehow able to neutralize J.J. You know, J.J.'s going to get his points. But Tech doesn't give 41 up to him or anything like that, and they don't give up a bevy of three-pointers to him. So they're able to somehow play those top two guys who are two outstanding ball players. They're able to play those guys to a standstill, and then that allows Dowdell and Gordon, you know, to really show how good they are and match up with the rest of the team. It's just be honest, Mike, I don't really remember how those 12 points were scored, because I thought
Tech
was out of it too, and I kind of only had one eye on the screen, and then I didn't really believe it till it was happening. But a great effort.
I thought the most impressive thing about the win over Duke last year, and mentioning Redick again, was that Duke got two last-second shots at it after Dowdell's three-pointer, but Redick didn't get either one of them. I thought that was the key to the game. They kept the ball out of Redick's hands for those last-second shots.
Are you sure about that? Didn't J.J. get one of those?
I thought Ewing had both of them. I'm almost certain he had both of them, and if I'm wrong, I'll stand corrected, but I'm pretty sure Ewing took both of them.
Oh, is that right? Okay. Well, I'll take your word for it. I don't recall right off the top of my head.
Hey, moving to another subject. I had Seth on earlier in the year, and I compared him to a NASCAR crew chief last year when, you know, everything's going great, man. You got a great running car. You can win any race. But when something isn't right, you can't come into the pits because you don't have any spare parts. Fancy way of saying you're going to be deeper this year. But so far it hasn't happened. You know, Spoon is not all the way back. Wynton Witherspoon just getting back. Robert Crobbendam, if he's not healthy in 2 weeks, are going to redshirt him. The freshmen aren't ready for big crunch time minutes yet. Now, refresh my memory, you were there. Against St. John's, he subbed one guy in the second half. The freshman didn't play. He basically went with the Iron Five, and it looks like it's going to be that way again. Iron Five plus one, not going to be a deep team. Do you see that as a concern?
Well, I think I do see it as a concern, because last year I think that's what killed them down the stretch, was they put up such a great effort, on the road a couple of times. They beat Georgia Tech on the road. They beat Miami on the road. And early in the year, Mike, they were able to bring up these good road efforts, but later on in the season they were getting mauled on the road, and they needed the energy of the home crowd to be able to play tough at home and win some games at home. So it's my thinking that, as the season wears on, that's not a good thing if he continues to play Gordon and Dowdell and Washington and Coleman Collins, 36 to 38 minutes a game. I think it's going to wear on him later in the year. So if all else being equal, Mike, if it goes the same as it did last year and they basically play 500 ball down the stretch, then that means the key is to front-end load the season with some wins. 7-3 right now, they need to get to maybe 11-4, something like that. So when they do enter that tough part of the ACC stretch and the road starts wearing them down, maybe they can get some wins at home and keep their head above water and hopefully make the NCAA.
It's odd that you say that, and I'm not going to giggle, but if you had said that the night this team lost to Bowling Green just two games into the season, I might have said, there goes all the NCAA talk. But now I'm starting to think this team has a shot at that, it can work.
Well, they've come together. The biggest thing that happened was, I agree with you, I felt pretty bad about them after those first three or four games, because they were given lackluster efforts. They just didn't come out of the gate very well this year, and this isn't a team that has a lot of time to mess around, because, what you wanted to happen was you wanted them to win 9 of those first 10 games or 8 of those first 10 games. Then they go out and lose to Bowling Green in the second game of the season. And I saw them a couple of times at that point in time, and they just didn't look good. There was just something that was amiss. And, then Coleman Collins, after the third game, went home to Georgia to see his dad for a couple of weeks. And for those that don't know, Coleman Collins' dad has lung cancer. And Coleman doesn't talk a lot about the specifics of it, but there have been printed reports that say that actually came out and just said he's dying of lung cancer. Not that he has it and he's not doing well, but that he's dying of it. So
he is in hospice care, I believe, now. It's very sad. And, if you know Coleman at all, you know what a family-grounded kid he is. So I'm amazed that he's come back and played.
He draws a tremendous amount of inspiration from his dad. His father is one of those that kept a close eye on him and taught him all the right things. His dad's just a great individual, and really, the maturity that you see out of Coleman Collins, I completely attribute to his dad.
And, I'm wondering, I wasn't privy to the conversation, but from the times I've talked to Coleman and the one or two times I've talked to his dad, when I gauged the relationship, I'm betting the father said, okay, son, enough feeling sorry for both of us. Here's how you do it. You go back there and kick some fanny for your dear old dad. And, like I say, it's a tough situation. People forget this kid's going to graduate college before he's old enough to drink. He started at 17. He's only 19 years old right now.
Yeah, I think he just turned 19. His birthday, if I remember correctly, is in October or something like that. So he just turned 19. He's going to get his degree next summer at the age of 19. So he's a tremendous individual, both from a maturity standpoint and an intelligence standpoint. And, yeah, whatever that conversation they had when he was down there, whatever they went through, he's been playing like a man possessed since he got back. I think he's been averaging something like 18 points and 10 rebounds a game since he got back. And he's playing with energy and a purpose. You know, I went to see the Radford game where they opened the season, and when he walked out on the court, Mike, he looked deflated. You know, I'm not sure if his mind was on his dad or what, but he just looked like the energy had been sucked out of him. You know, but he's been a different person since he got back from Georgia.
I'm going to ask you, Will, what's your biggest surprise to date? And I'll answer first and see if you agree with something else. And mine, this is going to sound like I'm dissing Marcus Sales, but I'm really not. It's just that 2 years ago when he played so many minutes and did so many things, you thought, well, you know, that's great. But as the talent upgrades there and the team gets better, that won't work. Well, here it is 2 years later. They are a significantly better team than they were 2 years ago, and he's still a vital part of it. You look at his numbers and you go, you know, what does he do? Well, one day he scores 11, maybe the other day he doesn't score any. But the kid has just got some basketball savvy that has been, I think, was valuable 2 years ago and has proven valuable again.
Yeah, when he played 2 years ago, that wasn't apparent to me, that what his contributions were. And then when he missed last year, you know, he got hurt and they decided to redshirt him. And Seth said, well, you know, he led us in minutes played last year. Wow, I hadn't even noticed that.
I didn't even realize that either. Yeah, I remember going, huh, and he did.
Yeah, and so what he's doing this year isn't really a surprise to me, having heard that, because, you know, I evaluated. They also missed him on defense a lot last year, you know, because of his size. I think he's 6'4", 6'5", and his wingspan and his ability to get out in the passing lanes. You know, Marquis Cook couldn't offer that when he was in the game. I just think they really could have used Marcus Sales last year. And a lot of people worried about when Carlos Dixon goes, yeah, we're going to miss his shooting, but we're going to miss his defense too. And the answer was no, you're not going to miss his defense because Marcus Sales can do that. And, you know, I looked at what he did in the second half against St. John's, and it was an excellent stat line. He had 8 points. He had 3 offensive rebounds. He had an assist. He had a steal and a block. And, oh, by the way, a turnover and 1 foul. And those were the only negative things he did in the second half of the game. So he's one of those quiet guys. I mean, everybody's starting to learn, Mike, how much Jamon Gordon contributes every game. But Sales is right behind him and just quietly doing positive things and not doing negative things.
Right. He's one of those you miss him when he's – maybe you don't notice him when he's there, but you sure miss him when he's gone kind of players.
It's I think if you ask me what my biggest surprise this season is, it's not so much Sales because I kind of expected that of him. I like the bonus they're getting every once in a while of double-figure scoring from him. But two things that have surprised me is how much better Jamon Gordon's shot is, how willing he is to put it up from behind the three-point line, and how you don't cringe anymore.
Right.
You know, I can't spout right off the top of my head what his shooting percentage is, but I think last year it was only about 20 or 22% from three-point range, and this year it's significantly better. And the other thing is, I know he's only 75%, but what little I've seen from Wynton Witherspoon, to me, he's taken a big step from last year. Last year, he looked like he had no clue what was going on. This year, he looks like he has a good clue, and I think once he gets 100%, I think he'll be a really valuable ball player.
Yeah, you could see the difference of him in a little bit in the preseason, and that's why that broken foot was so disappointing that he had made. I wrote a little bit about it. He made the physical adjustment, and he made an attitude adjustment. You get it a lot with freshmen. I think Shek Chikaiti's going through it a little bit now. You're not quite as good as you thought. You don't play quite as much. Marquis Cook never got over it. Witherspoon looks like he's gotten it over it. And as Seth said to me, he says he realizes we're not the enemy. We're here to help him, and now things are moving in a positive direction.
Well, what insiders said about Witherspoon last year was that he just didn't take the game seriously enough, that he just kind of goofed off a bit, didn't work as hard as he should, that he had a lot of potential, but he wasn't applying himself. And if I remember correctly, before he hurt himself, he had actually locked down the starting spot at small forward, I think.
He had, at the spot that Sales is now starting in.
Yeah, you know, and having seen what little bit of him I've seen, I can believe that. I can believe that they wanted to start him.
Well, let's switch to football. I said in my intro that one of the reasons I wanted you to be on tonight is that given the nature of fan interaction on your site and its message boards, and you have a much closer finger to the pulse of the fan base than any of the rest of us covering tech. The sense I've gotten, I have talked to any number of fans who are going to the bowl, plenty of people going. But every single one, without exception, has given me a variation on the, well, I'm going because it's my team down there playing kind of attitude. No one. I have not heard anybody express any kind of excitement about the actual Gator Bowl or this matchup. And is that your read, too?
I guess. You know, what little bit I've done asking around, it's interesting that you know a lot of people that are going because I don't know a lot of people that are going. You know, or I do know a lot of people that are ambivalent and really haven't made their minds up yet. I know there's not a lot of excitement over the matchup with Louisville, and I'm not really sure why that is. You know, Louisville has made a name for themselves last couple years, mostly by beating underpowered teams 69-15 and things like that. I guess there's not enough people around that remember the rivalry of Louisville and basketball and in the conference wars from the 80s and early 90s, or else there'd be a lot of venom directed towards Louisville. It's I'm not really sure if I can put my finger on it, Mike. You know, I mean, I blame part of it on the fact that Tech's going back to Jacksonville for the sixth time in 11 years. You know, this is going to be the fifth Gator Bowl plus the ACC championship game in the last 11 years, and that's just too much. You know, there's just not that much to do in Jacksonville, and it's a long drive. For those of you that like to drive to games, to bowl games, it's 540 miles, and you know, it's just, it's the venue, it's the fact that it's Louisville. Not to knock Louisville, because you could do a lot worse. You could be playing Cincinnati or Temple or somebody like that, but there's just not really anything to get fired up about. You know, can't quite put my finger on it, and just think it's a number of things.
You know, my wife went with me to San Francisco, and she went with me to New Orleans, and she said, well, do I want to go this year? I said, it depends. Why do you want to go? For the trip? For the city? There's no Garden District. There's no Golden Gate Bridge. Jacksonville is basically, you know, a little bit bigger Richmond. But if you want, nah, she said, yeah, I think I'll stay. Jacksonville, I don't have a problem with Jacksonville. I like Jacksonville. But like you say, been there way too much lately. I'd much rather be seeing somewhere new. But Matt, you bring up an interesting point. It's not, you know, everybody sees this Miami-LSU in the Peach Bowl. Miami, which will allegedly go into a lesser game, has this great glamour matchup against LSU in the Peach Bowl.
Yeah,
there's
right.
No glamour in this one. But, you know, it's one of those, the way I see it, you beat Louisville, people are going to be going, so what? But you can also lose to this team. I think it's a dangerous team, even without the Brohm kid at quarterback.
Yeah, you know, they're not going to be as deep as a team like Florida State or Miami, but they have some of the same attributes. They've got some speed, you know, and they're a team that when they get it going, yeah, they can run you over. You know, I think they took a big blow this week when they lost their starting defensive tackle. I can't remember the kid's name right off the top of my head, but, you know, he's probably fills a Jonathan Lewis role for him in that he frees up the defensive ends, particularly Doomerville. They're great defensive end. Yeah, he makes the guys around him better, and that's a big loss for them. We're talking 320 pounds.
Montavious Stanley, I think his name is.
Yeah, Stanley.
No relation to Montavious Pitts, the rapper.
Right.
Anyway.
It's a whole other topic.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's a 320-pound senior. I think he's one of their co-captains. You know, that's a big cog to lose. You wipe Jonathan Lewis out of the middle of the Tech defense, and that's a big difference.
Right.
And this is the kind of thing you're talking about. They're going to have to replace him with a guy who weighs 290, and they're going to have to start rotating some freshmen in as well. So that's a problem for them. But, you know, I've gotten off topic a little bit, you know, to get back on it, yeah, it's that classic case of it's like playing East Carolina. If you beat them, everybody says, so what? If they beat you, everybody points and laughs, you know. And, I know Tech fans, just the day after they'd lost the ACC championship game, I was talking to some guys, and you know, this is before the Gator Bowl was announced for sure. Everybody's really wishing for the Peach Bowl because, number one, it's in Atlanta where Tech hasn't been in almost 20 years. And number two is LSU, you know,
right.
One of the premier SEC teams. And, you know, you didn't get a great destination and you didn't get a great opponent.
A lot of people are saying that's probably the second best bowl game in terms of matchup and suspense behind the Rose Bowl. I mean, nobody thinks West Virginia, Georgia is going to be real good. I don't sense much excitement about Notre Dame, Ohio State, although I think that's probably a pretty good game. I'll tell you, the Orange Bowl could be a good game. But, yeah, I know what you're saying about this one. Louisville just doesn't have that football name like it does in basketball.
Yeah, they've built a good program for themselves. They have great facilities, and they've done a lot. Given that they're coming from Conference USA and this is their first year in the Big East, they've done a lot with their program. But, you know, it's just not something. And Virginia Tech faced this same thing in the early to mid-90s, you know, even into the late 90s. People just didn't get excited about playing them. You know, it takes a while, and you have to build up that national profile and get people excited about playing it.
One thing I picked up this weekend when I was over there for the basketball game, but that there's a feeling, there's kind of, you know, everybody, I told Greg Burton this at the end of his show, you know, everybody involved with Tech football is still down in the dumps, and it's not necessarily a concern now because there's been nothing to snap anybody out of it. Team's on break. It doesn't begin practicing again. There hasn't been a game yet. So it's not really a worry yet, but that there's some grumbling, too, that the fan base has become too hard to please, that 10 wins isn't good enough anymore. And I disagree with that strongly because I know last year's 10 wins had everybody going wazoo because it was so unexpected, the way it happened. I don't think it's the 10 wins that are disappointing people. It's the two losses and the way they happened, particularly the last one. You had a limping Florida State team basically run you down. So it's not 10-2 that's bad, but how the two occurred. They were very lopsided, a lot of similarities, a lot of problems handling speed. You agree with that?
Oh, yeah, totally. You know, it's not, in this case, it's not how many games you win, it's how you win them, what order they come in, how you lose them, all that sort of stuff. And college football is such a roller coaster ride. You know, everybody's ready to throw the coaching staff under the bus after 2003, and then they did a really good job on the comeback trail in 2004, and suddenly they looked like they were brilliant. And this year they've done some good things. The VT coaching staff has, and the team have, but you know, they got punched in the mouth a couple times by a couple teams that they thought they had caught up with and were on the same level with. So it's funny. It's you know, I don't want to say it's what have you done for me lately. It's just that the interesting thing about college football is how an individual game or two games can change your perception of a program. You know, there's a lot of ups and downs along the way, but over time you can see a steady line, and is that line going up or down or flat? You know, and it's easy to get caught up in what happens from game to game, and it bugs me too, Mike. You know, as somebody who follows the team and reports on the team, and whose subscription revenue is dependent upon how well the team does, you know, you like to see them do well. You don't like to see them look like they're facing something that's not easy to surmount. And what Miami's and Florida State's defensive lines did to Tech's offensive line, you know, you don't turn that oil tanker around overnight. It takes time to fix. And I think people are, you know, it's shaking their confidence a little bit.
Three All-ACC players on that line, two first-teamers and a second-teamer. Yet the common denominator in the two games, I mean, the defense wasn't that bad. What was it, 304 yards against Miami? A 29-yard touchdown drive and a no-yard touchdown drive. Florida State game, less than 300 yards. Mm-hmm. Had that punt return. But the offensive line just didn't do, I mean, is that the common denominator in your mind, too, in both games?
Yes, absolutely. Everybody, you know, points at the offensive coordinating and, you know, just being an observer of the game and never having coached, you know, offensive coordinators take a beating. You know, they're easy targets. And, I mean, you know that from observing college football over the years that, you know, people used to curse Larry Coker when he was Miami's offensive coordinator and say that his offense had no imagination or anything. And I thought they were a great offense. You know, so offensive coordinators are easy punching bags, but, you know, that offensive line really just didn't do a good job in those two games. And, you know, one play that really stands out to me from that Florida State game, it was probably Virginia Tech's third play of the game, Mike. They had a they called a play, you know, I don't know the technical term for it, but it was a misdirection type run where Vic pulled back from center, started to the right, the offensive line went to the right, and he put the ball in Cedric Humes' belly, and you could see that the blocking had developed in a way that all Cedric Humes had to do was cut left and accelerate, and he had a lot of real estate. But Broderick Bunkley, the defensive tackle for Florida State, had blown up Jason Murphy and just pushed him completely into the backfield. And when Vic handed off to Humes 5 yards in the backfield, Bunkley was there, and he tackled him. One block blew what was really a good play call and a play that was developing nicely. You can't blame that one on the coordinator.
No. And that's all it takes sometimes, one block. Bunkley had a lot to prove. I always confused he and Kamarion Wimbley, but they're both pretty darn good players.
Yeah. You know, and another thing that stands out about me about that game is we ran a photo gallery the following week, and there was a photo we ran of Marcus Vick on his back foot heaving the ball downfield to the left. And that picture was taken from behind Marcus to his left, so it kind of had a right-hand perspective on it. 10 yards downfield is Jeff King. He's just run a button hook. He's wide open. 5 or 10 yards behind him, Josh Morgan is wide open. Where was Vic throwing the football? He's probably throwing it 30 yards downfield into double coverage. You know, you can't blame that one on the offensive coordinator.
No, and I've noticed, and you analyze it a little more closely than I do when you do your weekly analysis, that if there is one knock on Marcus, he kind of locks in on somebody and doesn't get off him.
Well, see, that's encouraging, though, because he has all offseason to look at film and work with Kevin Rogers, and that part of his game will get better. He definitely did have a rough second half of the season relative to the first half.
Final question for Will Stewart, who is gracious enough to join us as he busily prepares for Christmas as well. Back to what I mentioned a little bit earlier, this thing about everybody being down in the dumps. My theory is it's not something to be concerned about yet. Teams taking exams, they practice four times before they come home. They don't snap at it, then it's a problem. But until then, don't worry. Now, do you think this team can snap out of it? Do you think this team will find reason to get up for Louisville? Because I think it can beat Louisville if it's at its best, but I think if it goes down there with a hangdog attitude, it's going to get stomped.
I think it's going to be close. You know, I don't know where these kids are going to look for inspiration. You know, I know that the seniors are going to realize it's their last game, and they're going to want to play hard and win. And I know that the coaches are going to want to win, because if you lose this one, Mike, then you've lost three out of your last five, and here come the naysayers again. So there's a lot to play for, but it's really difficult to, you know, a theory I have, and I think this played itself out in the Florida State game. I think everybody goes down there with certain things in mind. They have certain motivations and certain feelings about how things are going to go. I think they also have fears. And a play can happen early in a game that gives you confidence or activates your fears. You know, I know that as an observer watching the ACC championship game, the play that really jumped out to me was on Florida State's, I don't know, second or third or fourth play on offense, when they just chucked the ball downfield 40 yards to Greg Carr. Roland Miner had him covered like a blanket, made a great play, actually hit the ball, and Carr caught it anyway. And I remember sitting in the stands and thinking, here we go, we're going to have a game, because Florida State just made a play, and mentally they're in it. If Tech and Louisville go down there, Marcus Vick drops back, throws out to the flat, and some Louisville defensive back grabs it and runs it 40 yards for a touchdown, you're going to have a game. If Tech goes down there and hits an 80-yard pass on the first play of the game, you know, who knows, maybe Louisville will fold because they're missing their starting quarterback and missing one of their best senior defensive players. I think you won't really know until they kick that thing off and you play 5 minutes and see what happens.
All right. Well, I'll be there. They don't give me any choice. I'd prefer to be in Fort Lauderdale or Pasadena or Atlanta, but they say Jacksonville, so the media corps will pack up and we'll go follow the team there. I appreciate your time, sir.
Thanks, Mike. I enjoyed it.